Old Testament Foundations 101 was what I called these first four. And as you can see, we're actually building a foundation. And I'm hoping by the time we get through the fourth one, between your lessons and the lecture, you'll have a good understanding of this period of history so that you'll have all the pieces that you need to continue on. The first one was, if I could go back and rename them now, would be God's purpose and promise. And we saw that God created the earth and everything in it for a purpose and a plan, and that God placed the man and the woman in the garden to be his representatives, that we were created in his image and in his likeness. And then we saw how God's original plan was that there would be peace and harmony between God and man and man, and animals and man, and nature and man. And everything that he created was very good. I have to do this. I really have to do this. It was good at the day six when he had the man. And then he said, it's not good for man to be alone. And it was only after the woman that it was very good. Look at it. Look it up in the text. However, I do have to say that it's a little like doing a jigsaw puzzle. You know, when one piece is missing, it doesn't quite look right. And when you put the last one in, then it's complete. And it wasn't that that piece was so particularly good. It's just that it completed the picture. So I do have to say that when the woman was added, she made it complete according to how God planned it. And afterwards, it was all very good. We saw that that changed. And we all know the reality of where we live is broken relationships. But that wasn't God's original design. That resulted as sin in the garden. And we saw how there was another one of God's creation that wanted the position that the man and the woman had. He wanted authority over the earth. And so he came into the garden and used deception and temptation. What's the purpose of a test? Build you up. What's the purpose of temptation? To destroy you. Satan came in and used temptation, and he took God's word and twisted it just a little bit to make her doubt and question. But she had the choice whether she would obey or disobey, and she chose to disobey. And at that time, sin came into the world. The relationship was broken. What else came into the world at that time?
Death.
Death and fear. And that was an important point. There was no fear before this, and so fear came in at that point. Then we went into foundation number two. After we saw what God's original purpose and plan was and how that was broken, then we said that God immediately began his plan by which he would restore that relationship. And we got to lesson two, which was God's promise to Abram. And he told Abram to leave your country, your people, and your father's household and go to a land where I will show you. And we talked about how God then worked with Abram and he made a covenant. And if you weren't here last week, I would encourage you to get the lecture tape on the covenant. We saw how God made a covenant. He cut a covenant in blood and why Jesus had to die as part of that covenant. So we had God's original purpose, God's promise, and now we're going to get to God's place. Because if you notice, when he spoke to Abram, he said, leave your country and your people and your father's household and go to the land where I will show you. So as important as the people is the place that God chose to put his nation. Go back to your history lessons from high school. You remember the Fertile Crescent? And this is, Abram was called out of the Ur of Chaldees, which was actually Mesopotamia that's over here. And this is where they think the Garden of Eden probably was. But again, it's our best guess. We don't know. He left and he got as far as Haran up here. And we realized at that time that he had his family with him because he had to stay there until his father died. And then he continues on from here and he comes down into what is called Canaan here. This is the Fertile Crescent, but what he was doing was following the trade route. That's how he was traveling. We saw how God had prepared the people. He began with Abram and he built a nation. And if you think back to your lessons, I think it was last week or maybe 2 weeks ago. At the end of Genesis, we have Abram now is a family of 12 sons that become what? The 12 tribes. But they go into Egypt because of a famine, and there they change from a nation of 12 sons into 70 people to the time of Moses. Did you see how many people the best guess is, came out of Egypt? 2 million plus. We don't know. There's varying numbers that range anywhere from 1 million to 3 million. But even at an estimate of 2 million people, that's quite a nation. And God was working with them. He had done what he had promised Abram. He would bless him. He would give him descendants. He would make him into a great nation. But a nation needs a place. And the place that God had given him was called Canaan. Canaan's a fascinating word. It means purple. Canaan means purple and actually comes from the shells of the Merik shellfish, which was along the coast of Phoenicia. And so Canaan really meant the land of purple. Now we know about the Canaanites, and the Canaanites were the people that were involved in trading. They used this purple for a dye, and those that actually traded in it, or traders or merchants, were called the Canaanites. If you think about that, it was a natural culture. So what was their garments made out of? It was made out of sheep and goats. So what would the colors be? They would be natural. It would be maybe varying shades of brown and black at the most. So the purple was very important, and it was used for royalty. Now, when we continue on in our study through the Bible, we find out that this particular area that we call Israel changes names many times. And it's important for us to understand all those different names. So immediately, when Israel goes in, it's called Israel. But if you think about it, what was the people associated with Abram called at this point, early in Genesis? Do you remember what they're called? They're called Hebrews. Did you ever wonder where the name Hebrew came from? Well, Hebrew is actually Eber. Abram was a descendant of Eber, and so they called him the Hebrews. And that's where that name came from. But when Jacob wrestled, you remember that story from a couple weeks ago? He had this wrestling going on. And afterwards, his name was changed from Jacob, which meant heel grabber, to Israel, which means one who struggles with God or God strives. And that's the meaning of the word Israel. So by this time, when they start going into the promised land, we think of Israelites. But it doesn't refer to the land of Israel. It refers to the descendants of Israel, meaning Jacob. But it also goes back to the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You confused yet? Well, just in case you aren't, we're going to add another one. Because when we get into the section where we're going to be studying in the Kings, next week we're going to get into the Kings and the monarchy. They start out as a united kingdom, but then they split into 10 northern tribes, 2 southern ones. The northern kingdom retains the name of Israel, but the southern kingdom takes on the name of Judah, which is the dominant tribe. So then we're going to call it Judah. How did we get Jews? Jews actually means Judahites. And this comes in when Judah is taken into captivity in the Babylonian captivity. Most of the people who go into captivity are from the tribe of Judah. So they become the Judahites, shortened from Jews, and that came to represent all of the descendants of Israel. In case you aren't confused yet, we got a couple more to go. Israel, after the 10 northern tribes are taken off into Assyrian captivity and disappear, Judah, the southern tribe, takes on the name of Israel because they said, we're it, and they need to represent the whole of Israel. So when we get into the text in Kings, they're going to use Judah, and then they're going to use Israel. And we have to understand that it refers, when there's only two, it means we're all of us, but there's only two tribes. Do you know what it's called today besides Israel? Palestine? Have you ever heard that term? That's an interesting term. Because originally this area was called Philistia. We saw that when we were studying Genesis, and that was a term that was used by the Egyptian society for this area. Later, about the time Israel's in there, the Philistines come in. There's some sea people, and so it becomes the land of the Philistines on the coast there. And so between Philistia and the Philistines, they took the name Palestine. But I want you to know where the name Palestine actually became popular. It was actually during the Roman era. Hadrian was the emperor of Rome, and he wanted to remove any evidence of Jewish influence in the area, so he started calling it Palestine. So today you will find that the Arabs over there call it Palestine, and the Jews will call it Israel. And if you're over there, both terms are politically loaded. But that's next week's lesson when we talk about the people. So why did God put his people Israel in the land of Canaan? It's important for us to understand exactly what God was doing. I don't know if you can, hopefully you can all see this. This was the superpowers of the day. Actually, the Hittite nation was up here. You're going to have Assyria that's already rising up, Babylon, Persia, and down here is Egypt. If you were going to go between any of the superpowers, you had to follow the trade route. And the trade route followed this yellow line. Where does the trade route go? Right through Israel. But if you think about that, what was God's promise to Abram? I will bless you. I will make you a great nation. I will give you a land. And through you, all the nations of the world will be blessed. Now, when I thought of Israel originally, I thought of it as like Iowa, or maybe where my mother grew up, Beersford, South Dakota. You really got to be going there. I mean, there's a welcome to Beersford sign here, and then two blocks later it's thank you, call again. And if you blink, you're going to miss the whole town. And I thought, well, God's people were just kind of protected, and they were all these little people. But that's not the truth. God put them right where everybody in the world would have to pass through their territory. Why? So that they would see the relationship that God had with his people, and the whole world would come to know that he's the one true God. This trade route here is actually, during the time of Abraham, called the trunk route, but it later comes to be known as the Via Maris, the Way of the Sea, and that's the most popular name. There's also another trade route that comes up from here, which is the spice route, and that's called the King's Highway, and that goes through what we'll know as the Transjordan. That's a much more difficult route, and it didn't go, it really wasn't the main route. The main route is right here, the one that Abraham took, and it's called the Via Maris. Ray Vanderlaan, in his study, he calls it the crossroads of the world, and that's really what it was. It was the crossroads, and it was there that God was going to show the world that he's the one true God. It's an interesting land because it's not like Egypt that has the Nile River. The Nile River floods on a regular basis, and as it floods, it brings nutrients, and it's so fertile on the strip around it that they can literally plow it with their foot. It's that soft and fertile, and everything grows there. Or the area over here in Mesopotamia, where you've got the Tigris and Euphrates. You can always depend upon them. This is a very harsh land. It's a land that's dependent upon God to provide rain and the seasons and the harvest. In Deuteronomy chapter 11, under when Moses gave the law, he said, and if you want to turn to it, it's Deuteronomy 11, beginning with verse 8. Therefore, be careful to obey every command I am giving you today, so you may have strength to go in and occupy the land you are about to enter. If you obey, you will enjoy this land, long life in the land God swore to your ancestors and to you and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. For the land you are about to enter and occupy is not like the land of Egypt from which you came, where you planted your seed and dug out irrigation ditches with your foot as a vegetable garden. It's a land of hills and valleys and plenty of rain, a land that the Lord your God cares for. He watches over it day after day throughout the year. If you carefully obey all the commands I am going to give you today, if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul, and if you worship him, then he will send the rains in their proper season so you may harvest crops of grain, grapes for wine, and olives for oil. He will give you this lush pasture land for your cattle to graze in, and you yourselves will have plenty to eat. But do not let your hearts turn away from the Lord or worship other gods. If you do, the Lord's anger will burn against you. He will shut up those skies and hold back the rain, and your harvests will fail. Then you will quickly die in that good land the Lord is giving to you now. So commit yourselves completely to these words of mine. Tie them on your hands as a reminder. Wear them on your foreheads. Teach them to your children. Talk about them when you are at home and when you are away on a journey and when you are lying down and when you are getting up. Write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates so that as long as the sky remains above the earth, you and your children may flourish in the land the Lord swore to give to your ancestors. You recognize them now as the blessings and the curses as part of the covenant. God says, if you obey, here's what I will provide for you. I'll provide you rain. I'll make sure that you have harvest, that you have everything. So Israel was a very important land because it was not only what? A land that was dependent upon God, but also where? And here's another, just another view of the trade route where you can see how important it is. It goes right through the heart of Israel. Again, in Isaiah, God said, you are my witnesses, declares the Lord, that I am God. And in Kings, it says, you are my witnesses, so the world will know that I'm the one true God. One thing I discovered when I was in Israel that totally blew me away was everything that I thought I knew about the land was wrong. And so I said that when I came back, I was going to make sure that everybody I had a chance to talk to would actually understand the topography of that land because it is so critical to our understanding. God always gives us detailed information. He tells us where and how. And here's a kind of a slice, a cross-section of the land. Is that? Yeah. It can be, it's usually divided into four slices, but it really can be divided in six. Can you see that? Over here is the Mediterranean Sea. And you got the coastal plain right here. Then you've got the Shephelah. Then the hill country of Judah. Here's the Judean Desert. Then this is the Rift Valley or the Jordan Valley. And then you come up here on the Transjordan side. So I want to share with you just a little bit about each one of these areas because it's fascinating. This is a very small nation. Very small nation. You can see all of these. I'm going to show you a picture later. The first area is called the coastal plains. And you think about Mediterranean coast. Oh, this is just a wonderful area. Well, let me tell you what it was like in the time of Abram. Swamps, lagoons, forests around the edge, and it included wild animals like lions and leopards and bears. It has no natural harbor along here. The coastal plain is about 2 miles wide here, and it goes to the Ayalon Valley here and extends out to about, where's my notes here? I better get it right. 12 miles wide at the widest part. It was an area that the Philistines settled in. You can see there the Philistine cities, if you're familiar with them, Ekron, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaza, and in there would be Gath. Right about in here. So that's where the Philistines settle in right there. But it's not lush resort area like we think of. Now today it's pretty nice over there. But it's not what you would think of. Next is the Shephelah. This is an area that is, well, this morning I was able to put up two overhead so you can kind of see it. But the Shephelah is the foothills. Can you see how that kind of goes? It goes up. It's called the foothills or the lowlands. And this was a very important area because it was flat, and that was about one of the only areas you could run chariots. And consequently, we have a lot of the battles that we see in the early times taking place in there. In fact, the way that you would go from the coast to the mountains was through these natural valleys. We have the Valley of Lachish, the Valley of Elah, which is where David and Goliath met, the Valley of Sorek, and the Ayalon Valley. And you can only really travel through these various valleys. It was interesting because we saw that when they first went in with Joshua, they took the mountain area up here, and the trunk route, or the Via Maris, actually goes right along the edge of the coastal route in the Shephelah, because that's the only place that you can really travel in there because of the topography. So whoever controlled the Shephelah could prevent the mountain people from coming down or the coastal people from going up, and also controlled the trade route. So God said, go in and take control of the whole land. but they kind of left this area here. When we got into the Judges, Samson lived right in the Shephelah area, in that area. The next is the Central Mountains. And Israel, when they first came in, settled that area. You can see the mountain range. That's the hill country of Judah. They settled there because they weren't a very sophisticated people. They'd been slaves for 400 years, then they'd been nomads for 40 years. And so they come into the land and they're not sophisticated. They actually live in small adobe kind of hut things. And so it was easier to protect their area when they were up in the hills than it would be down on the Shephelah or in the coastal areas. This is a very interesting area because it starts at Mount Carmel, which is up here. You remember what happened on Mount Carmel? Those of you that were here last year in the study? Elijah and the prophets of Baal fought up there with the Battle of the Gods up there. So this mountain range begins here and it goes along here. And it's about 1,970 feet here and it goes up to about 3,200 and 80 feet along there. There is no easy passage across there. Even today, there's only one main route, which is the Hebron-Jerusalem-Nabalis Road. There's some areas up here that are easily traversed, but these are very difficult. They call them hills, but they're very difficult mountain areas. The next slice is the Judean desert and wilderness, and this is the one that blew me out. I always pictured the wilderness as the Sahara Desert. Do you see what the wilderness is? It's the backside of the mountains. It's very steep, very difficult. It's called wilderness because it doesn't get much rain. It goes to the shores of the Dead Sea, but if you see, there's still a drop of 656 feet when you go down into the Jordan Valley, which is the Rift Valley from the Judean desert there. That's where David spent all his time running and hiding. He was in the Judean desert. And I'm going to show you some pictures of that later, but I want you to kind of visualize it in your mind. Then the next one, you can see how it drops down now where the Dead Sea is. It's called the Jordan Valley, but it's also the Rift Valley. And that is a natural break in the Earth's crust, and it begins up here at Mount Hermon. It goes all the way down to Africa. And what's amazing about this Rift Valley is it's about 1,312 feet below sea level. So we start in Israel up here. If you start at the mountains here at 3,280 feet, within 12 miles you drop down to 1,312. And then you get to the Dead Sea, which is another 2,600 feet deep. So now you're down to 3,912 feet below sea level. And this is only in like a 12-mile range. It's very small area that we're not even familiar with. Again, along here, the Jordan Valley. It comes from Mount Hermon up here. It runs down into the Sea of Galilee. And this is a very beautiful, crystal clear lake. You can see the entire thing, the entire sea from, if you were standing on something as high as this, it's only got to be a few miles across, maybe 6 miles at the most. But it's called the sea. It's fresh water. It's got fish. It's got all sorts of sea life in it. And then it continues down, and the Jordan Valley actually cuts another valley within the valley and drops down even further to the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is the most interesting body of water you'll ever imagine. How many of you have been in the Dead Sea? You go in there, and first off, we'd been hiking, so we had abrasions from all over, from climbing in these mountains, and every single one is like pouring salt in it because the mineral content is so high, and you're like a cork. You try to go under the water and you pop up and you end up sitting with your knees out of the water. It's just absolutely unique. And then when you get out, you feel like you've been covered in baby oil. I've never experienced anything like it, and 2 minutes in there was enough. But it's a fascinating body of water. And like I said, it starts at 1,312 feet below sea level and goes down to 3,912 feet below sea level. There are no major roads that go through this Jordan Valley because it is still too difficult to traverse. If you think about the time that Israel went in there, you have to understand that I want you to see this picture and get this in your mind, because the Jordan is not very deep. It's not very wide right now because they stop it up. But look at the terrain they're coming down from. And all along here was dense shrubs and vegetation. And that's, again, where the lions and the tigers and the bears, lived. The last area is the Transjordan, which also contains several mountain ranges. So I forgot to tell you, in the coastal mountains, we've got the Hebron Mountains, the Judean Mountains, and the Samarian Mountains. And it's interesting because there's a major valley here, and this is where a lot of the battles take place. Does anybody know what's in what major cities in the Jezreel Valley? Megiddo. Is anybody familiar with the name Megiddo? How does that translate out in end times? Armageddon, the Valley of Armageddon. This is quite possibly where the final battle will take place, right in there. That's beautiful. Right now, these areas, the Jordan Valley is lush, the Jezreel Valley is lush, but because they bring in water. It's just like saying Palm Springs is wonderful and lush, and so is Las Vegas. Well, they're lush because man brings in it, but if you think about it in its original setting. So what I want to do is take you there, because pictures are worth a thousand words. We read that you can see the whole land. Remember, Abram went up and he could see the entire land. I didn't think that was possible, but here's a picture very close to covering the whole land. Here's the coastal plain, and then you got the Shephela, you got the wilderness area down into the Rift Valley here, and here's the plain of Moab's there. You really can see on a clear day across the entire country because it is so small. I think at its widest part, including the Transjordan, which trans is across the Jordan, is 110 miles from there to the Mediterranean Sea. So do you kind of have a little picture in your mind now of the topography and wilderness? So let me continue on with the wilderness here. This is the pasture land. Can you see that? See all the lush green vegetation here?
That's right. Hey.
Here's your wilderness up here. This is pretty smooth and pretty normal, and we think about, when I think about pasture land, I'm from the Midwest, so I think about, you know, knee-high wheat and alfalfa and all these kind of things. This is the pasture land. We walked through it, and we didn't know it. And he said, now look at your shoes. And our shoes had all these little stripes across them from the damp grass. And he says, that's the grass. And we said, where? And he said, go find it. Well, next to a rock, there's a little bit, and a lot of it is watered. In fact, the Mediterranean gets 200 days of moisture, some of it by rain, but a lot of it by dew. And even the desert gets dew. But as soon as the sun comes up, it's gone. So when we're talking about pastures, we're not talking about much. God gives them just enough for the day, because then they have to wait for the next day to get the next biteful. Kate asked about the Bedouins. Here's current Bedouins. This is what they look like. These are what we call semi-nomads because they're actually coming right up next to civilization, but that's got lush pasture lands. They're living in tents, and there's the lush pasture lands, okay? And there's their herds and flocks. And if you don't believe me, I'll show you them on the hills. That's the pasture lands. That's exactly what you had in mind when you think about pasture land in the Bible, right? That's exactly what you think of when you think of David's 23rd Psalm. Okay, like I said, I was so surprised when I got there. Yeah, well, let me take you, because I'm going to go to that one. Remember I told you that Jericho was an oasis in the Rift Valley. So here's Jericho. You're coming down out of the wilderness into the Rift Valley, and you see the lush valley of Jericho. Here's the roads. Here's the Jericho Road. Now, I was very nervous. I don't like heights and I don't like sheer drops, and a lot of this road is missing. And so I chose to go by this nice road over here. The people that were walking there said, we were so afraid because we were on this bus. And when the bus, the back end's over here, and every time you take a turn, half the bus off the road and the other half's on, and then the front is off and the back is off. So it doesn't matter which way you go. You're either going to walk and hope you make it, or you're going to ride the bus and hope you don't fall off. But that was the Jericho Road. So you see why when I was talking about how important it was to have a foot lamp so that you would see. But look at this. This is a closer-up of the Jericho Road. We don't understand what they went through to travel. This is how they travel. In fact, we came across people that were actually still using this, traveling by foot. Notice this deep drop down here. This is called a wadi. And I mention wadis a lot, and so I wanted to show you what a wadi is. We know them as a dry riverbank, but you don't get the perspective from this picture here. So I want to take you down into one of those wadis. So that's down in the wadi. That was the only place in Israel besides the Mediterranean Sea coast that I saw sand. Now, there will be water down in there, and that looks like a good place where you'd want to take animals. But I want you to keep in mind the sides here of these wadis, because what happens is water comes down from Mount Hermon, which has water all year long. I mean, snow all year long, so it can melt at any time. And you have no idea when it's going to come down. And more people die in the desert, in the Negev area, the southern part of Israel, because of drownings in the wadis than any other place. And this is what it looks like when it comes down. You saw how steep that was. You can't just get out. So you would never bring your animals down into the wadi to get water. What you're looking for is what David talked about, the still waters. And that's really an incredible place, because you're coming through the wilderness and you come across still water like this. It's just absolutely incredible. So that's the land where God put his people. A tough land, a rough land, and yet a place of influence. He gave his people strong warnings. He said, when you go into that land, do not defile yourself in any of these ways, because this is how the nations that I am going to drive out before you became defiled. Even the land was defiled, so I punished it for its sin, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you must keep my decrees and my laws. The native-born and the aliens among you must not do any of the detestable things. For all these things they are doing by the people who live in this land have made the land defiled. And if you defile the land, it will vomit you out as it vomited out the nations that are before you. When God tells Joshua to bring the people into the land, he said they are to totally wipe out the Canaanites. Now, we in our Western culture like to be nice. We want to say, this is awful. I want you all to write down Leviticus chapter 18. I want you to go home and read Leviticus chapter 18, and then you will understand why God said they were to totally wipe out these seven Canaanite nations. Everything that he created as good and holy and pure, they had defiled. Every kind of sexual perversion that you can even imagine and things you can't, they were involved in, as well as human and child sacrifice. So when we come to the places where God says, wipe out the Canaanites, it was for a very serious reason. God had put his people there to show them a different way, to influence the world and say, this was my plan, and this is how I relate to my people. Your story today, we talked a little bit about Joshua. He brought them into the land. I love Joshua. When we were going through this study, we discovered that Abraham built the nation, and then we went to the next leader, who was Moses, and he was really a shepherd leader. I'm going to talk about him, I guess, more next week. But when they came into the promised land, they needed a military leader. They needed an army general, and that was Joshua. And when they came over onto the land, one of the things that we don't necessarily realize is that when God brought them out of Egypt, he parted the Red Sea. We all know that story, right? enemy was coming. And so he parted it. They crossed on dry ground. When they got to the other side, the water closed over and protected them from the enemy. And then they were in the wilderness for 40 years, at which time he was building a nation, telling them who he was, teaching them, you can trust me. You saw the wilderness. That's the wilderness. It was mountainous. It was tough. And in that wilderness, it's hot. In fact, the Sinai area, 120, is common in the summer. Down in the Negev area, it never gets above 90. So you understand how important water was. God provided water. He provided food every day in the form of manna. What else did he provide? Can you think of some of the things?
The tabernacle.
Yeah, the tabernacle, but what else? The pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire saying, I am here with you, my presence. What about their clothes? They never wore out. If you're in that area, our tour guide says he goes through a pair of shoes in 6 weeks traveling on that. It never wore out in 40 years. God says, you can trust me here. When they went into the promised land, they had to cross the Jordan River. God parted the Jordan River. We don't necessarily know that. We don't pick up on that. We know about the Red Sea. Someone said in this group, because it was traumatic, you know, a lot of people died and it had good press. When they parted the Red Sea, the Jordan River, they went through on dry ground. Now you have to understand, they had to go down those steep cliffs and back up. It was treacherous, plus there was wild animals in there. But what we don't necessarily see is when they went into that land and he closed the water behind them, they were fully committed. Now they were in the land of the enemy with no escape. When they'd come through the Red Sea, they were safe in the desert with the enemy behind. Now they're in the promised land with the water closed. They are committed. And God says, now I'm ready to show the world through you who I am. Joshua went in, and I'm just going to briefly go through his campaigns because it's kind of interesting. We saw how he first went into Jericho, and now you see it's in the Rift Valley. It's right there by the Jordan River. And then he takes the central area. He goes into Jericho. We didn't have time to fully develop it, but that was the first city in the promised land, and so they were to give it back to the Lord as a burnt offering of the first fruits. That was saying, God, this is the promised land you promised to Abraham. You're now about to give it. We give it all back to you in anticipation that you will give us the rest of the land. And I know I'm going to forget this at the end, but did you notice our neighbors over here at the Chabad? They're celebrating the Feast of the Tabernacles. So when you go out, you'll see their tents out there, and they've got palm branches all there. They're following that. So Joshua then goes in, he takes the city of Ai, which is the second city, and notice he's following a pattern here. He's actually following a valley, because that's how he has to travel. And so the next one in line is the Gibeons. So it would be Jericho, Ai, and Gibeon. The Gibeons saw him coming. They knew what God was doing, and they decided they'd come up with a plan. So the Gibeonites got on old clothes, worn out clothes, took stale bread, and they went over to the camp and said, we've come from a very long ways and we've heard about all that God has done for you, and we want to make a peace treaty with you. And rather than asking the Lord, they said, okay, and they made a peace treaty with them. They made a covenant. They cut a covenant with them. Then they start their campaign again and realize the very next town is these people. They didn't come from a long way. But because God's covenant had been cut with them, they couldn't conquer them. And it wasn't too long later that the other neighboring kings found out what the Gibeonites did, and they wanted to attack Gibeon because they'd made peace with Israel. And so they sent word to Joshua saying, you got to come save us. So Joshua ended up actually saving the city of Gibeon rather than destroying it. I want us to understand a little bit about these cities. These cities are very small. We're talking maybe an acre or two. And each city that's walled has their own king. So when they're talking about all these kings of the area, it would be like a king of Deerfield and a king of the ranch and the king of the colony. And even those would be very large, but they would be walled cities. And then all the farmland and the small areas around those cities would become part of their kingdom. You know what the city itself is called in Scripture? The mother. And the areas around it is called the daughters. So when we get into Scripture and they're talking about how the daughters are being destroyed and all this type of thing, they're actually talking about the city is the mother and the area around the outside is the one that gets it first when an enemy comes in. And so they would flee to the city, and they also brought all their harvests and everything into the city so that it could be protected. So all that's going to come into play as we continue on. But Joshua comes in here, he goes does the central, and then he goes down in the southern area. And notice he's just taking a few major cities, because if you control the mothers, then you control the area. We saw the covenant renewal ceremony. I hope you saw that when they first came into the promised land, that they followed with the sign of the covenant, which was circumcision. They observed Passover. And there was so much in there. I wish I had more time to develop this, but this is an overview. So you can go back onto the website. Tom has put everything on there for you now if you want to go back and do those other lessons. But on Mount Ebal and Gerizim, which is by Shechem, then the covenant ceremony was renewed again with a new generation, the first generation that went into the land. After he did the central and southern, then he went up in the northern section, and he went up along, it almost looks like he goes along the Rift Valley, but he's just kind of following it up here and up to here. And this is the area that he conquered. And after he conquered it, they were to go in and settle the land. And one of the, well, let me show you the 12 tribes, because this is important. Did you understand the 12 tribes? I mean, it's a difficult concept. There are always 12 tribes. And if you're talking about the actual sons, you will come up with a group of names that include Joseph and Levi, which are the 12 sons. But if you're talking about the land distribution, Levi doesn't get a land. Why doesn't Levi get a land? Because they're the priests, and God is their inheritance. But if he gave them a land, they would be separated. So he gave them cities, so they would be distributed out throughout all of the tribes so that they could be the teachers and they could continue on and influence. And then the offerings that were given to the Lord would become ways of providing for their needs. But they were basically full-time ministers, if you wish, or full-time priests for them. But when you take the tribe of Levi out, you only have 11 tribes, and you got to have 12. So then they removed Joseph and included his two sons, which is Ephraim and Manasseh. When they were coming into the promised land, they come through the Moab area. They were in the wilderness 40 years. That's a whole nother story we won't get into. But do you have any idea how long it would have taken them if they took the trade route from Egypt to Canaan? 10 days. Of course, if you're moving with that many people, it might take you 20 days. But it took them 40 years because God was preparing a nation that was stubborn. But anyway, we think of it's a long way, but it's not all that far. They came through the plains of Moab, and this area over here was very lush compared to the rest of the land. And so Reuben, Gad, and half of the families from the tribe of Manasseh said, you know what, we like it right here. We want to stay here. God said, okay, you can have that land, but then when we go into the promised land, you have to go first into battle. And we also know that because they're on the Transjordan, they're on the other side of the Rift Valley. Now, hopefully you've got a picture of in your mind of what it's like, because when a battle comes, when the enemy comes from the outside, where is it going to hit first? They're not going to come from the coast. So they're going to hit this, and you've got this natural rift that's going to keep the rest of Israel from being able to get to you quick. And we're going to see that their choice to live in the most comfortable land would actually result in their demise first, because when you go through Joshua and when you go through Judges, you find that that area is constantly under siege. So here's the 12 tribes. We have 9.5 in here. I think I'm going to give this to you next week. We'll get into the people that have to do with it next week. The other piece I wanted to share with you that was another one of those, I can't believe that this is not what I thought it was Joshua divided up the land in land inheritance. Moses did part of it, and then Joshua finished it according to the Lord. Everyone was given a land inheritance, which was essentially their farmland. They lived in cities, but they had to provide for their own food. Now, do you have a picture in your mind of the farm? Okay? Are you ready? Okay, here it is. I wish this was, it was a little bit hazy that day, so I didn't get a very good picture. But here's the city where they live. This is their farms. Everybody's farms in the same location. And the farm is, or the land inheritance, is about 50 feet wide, and it can be 100 or maybe 200 feet at the most. And your land inheritance might be right next to your neighbors, or it might be within the borders of your neighbors. So when Joshua says you can't move your border stones, well, if you do, it's going to make somebody else's change too. You can't do that. But when you get right down in this lush farmland, this is what it looks like. That's good farmland. And, okay, here's the rocks, here's the good soil, here's the path. Because in order to get to the next farm, you got to walk on this path, which is basically a rock wall, in order to get to your farm. These are the land inheritance that Joshua gave. They're still there today. I got to thinking, okay, the firstborn son gets a double inheritance. They get a double inheritance of the same land that Joshua gave to the family back then. So what it has to do with the produce, that what you produce from there for your family. It's interesting because they also share this land with the sheep. After it's harvested, the sheep get to come and finish it and fertilize it, and then it's ready to harvest it for the next year. The last part we got to today had to do with Judges, and you just saw that it was a cycle. Israel disobeyed the Lord, they followed idols, and that always resulted in what God said, oppression from the enemies. They'd go through a varying range from a few years to many, many years, and finally they'd cry out to God, he'd send them a deliverer, and then they'd have peace. And then they'd forget, and they'd go through that cycle, and it goes around and around and around, and that pretty much is their history. They had 11 judges in the book of Judges. One was a woman. Her name was Deborah. And that could be summed up in everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Kind of a sad commentary, isn't it? For a land that's supposed to influence the world, saying, he is the one true God. Just in closing today, I wanted you to see the land so that you could get a picture in your mind, because if you're like me and you grew up in the church, you were singing hymns and all sorts of things about this wonderful land, and for some reason I got an idea that it was a destination, that it's this beautiful, beautiful land, and when we get there, everything's perfect. I want you to understand that's not the land of Canaan. The land of Canaan is not a destination, it's a journey. It's a place where God put his people so that they could influence their entire world. So by looking at their lives and how they interacted with God, the world would know that he's the one true God. It's the same for you and I. God has placed us in our land, and talk about a crossroads. Irvine is definitely a crossroads. And we have the opportunity by our relationship with Christ for people to look at us and say, see how our relationship is, and saying, you know, he is the one true God. Milk and honey is very interesting. That has to do with herds and produce. And it was, if you think about the Abrahamic covenant, last week we talked about walking the blood path. God took both parts. He said, if you fail to obey, I promise these things. That won't change. But when we come into the Mosaic covenant that we went through last week, the blessings and the curses are based upon obedience. If you obey, God says, I will send rain, and it will produce herds and new babies, and there will be plenty of milk from the herds. And I will produce crops that will have grain, and you will have wine, and you will have olive oil, and you will have honey, if you obey. If you disobey, then I will withhold it. And it was, that part was conditional. The blessings and the consequences, as well as remaining in the land, was conditional. The promise was not. But do you kind of get a picture of Israel now? Is it a little clearer? Is it coming clearer? Okay, we got one more building block, and that's the people. You need to understand all the people around there, because some of these names in the Old Testament seem very foreign at first, but as we get to know them, we find out they're really the same names over and over again. And the interesting part is most of them are family. And we're going to get into that as our final building block next week.